Romans chapter 15. And we'll read from verse 1. We then that are strong ought to bear the infirmities of the weak and not to please ourselves. Let every one of us please his neighbor for his good to edification. For even Christ pleased not himself, but as it is written, the reproaches of them that reproached thee fell on me. For whatsoever things were written aforetime were written for our learning, that we through patience and comfort of the Scriptures might have hope. Now the quotation in verse 3 was taken from Psalm 69 about the sufferings of Christ. But the principle of verse 4 applies throughout the Old Testament Scriptures, not just to the Psalms. Okay? So, I was asked to give an overview of the book of Genesis. I've never done it before. I've never prepared one before. So, it's a lot of work, and we'll just have to see how it goes. You can pray for me that the Lord will give needed help. Now, you've got the outline there. Some of it I'm going to just read for you, and maybe add some comments as we go along. First of all, as to its authorship. The first thing I'm going to say in connection with that, really, is that it really doesn't matter who the author was. The important thing is the final author was God himself. And that's the vital thing. There are books in our Bible that we do not know who the authors were. Some of them have got names at the top of them, but there is nothing in the context that indicates that that person was necessarily the writer. You think, for example, of Samuel. Samuel was dead before you come into 2 Samuel, so how Samuel wrote 2 Samuel, I don't know. So very obviously he was not the writer. But someone was the writer, and the ultimate writer was God himself. We don't really know who the writer of the Epistle to the Hebrews was. We're not told. There's a lot of supposition as to who it was, but really when it boils down to it, all we can really say is we do not know. Okay? So it's not vital to know who the author was. Now, Moses has been historically accepted as the author of Genesis. Although there are no Bible references confirming the Mosaic authorship of Genesis, there are numerous references to the book of Moses or the book of the law of Moses. This is affirmed by Jewish historians as a reference to what we call the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible. Now, notice particularly here in Nehemiah. In Nehemiah 8, the people instructed Ezra to bring the book of the law of Moses. Ezra publicly read from the book from morning to midday, verse 3. Verse 18 says, also day by day from the first day until the last day, he read in the book of the law of God. But when you come to chapter 9, in the prayer of the Levites, they summarize the history of Israel up until that time, beginning with the creation and the call of Abraham. They went on to refer to the Exodus, the giving of the law at Mount Sinai, and the rebellion at Kadesh Barnea. They referred to the conquest of the land and much more. In other words, they summarized the five books of Moses, beginning with Genesis. So, it has been almost universally accepted that the writer of the book of Moses, or rather of the book of Genesis, was Moses. Now, if you have difficulty over that because Moses wasn't even born yet, well, who was born when the opening chapters of the book of Genesis was written. Nobody was born yet. Yet, we do have a record of what happened. And so obviously, it has come to us by revelation from God. Now, some have suggested that over the course of time, someone put together all the various things that had been stated by the various people, but even they didn't know. So I would suggest to you that the writer is Moses himself, and he wrote by divine inspiration from God. Okay? Now, it's vital that we stand there as believers. The moment we have any difficulty as to the verbal inspiration of the Scriptures, then we're in deep water as far as our Christian faith is concerned. Okay? Now then, the title. The title Genesis has been taken from the Septuagint, the ancient Greek translation of the Old Testament. You'll notice the letters LXX, that stands for 70, being between the 3rd and 2nd century BC. The Hebrew title, that is, if you looked at a Hebrew Bible, the Hebrew title is In the Beginning, which is actually the first word of the Hebrew text. That was a common thing with the Hebrews. I have noticed, just to give you an example, in the Russian Bible, when you come to the Song of Solomon, we call it the Song of Songs, which is Solomon's. But it's not called that in the Russian version. Let's have a look at that for a moment. My mind's gone a bit flat, so. Okay. You'll notice the opening words of the Song of Solomon are the Song of Songs, which is Solomon's, in the Russian Bible, and probably in the Hebrew too. That's not verse 1. That's the title of the book. And so that was a common thing as far as the Hebrews were concerned. The opening words quite often, not always, but quite often, form the title of the book. The Greek word, you'll notice I've got it in Greek letters there for you, is Genesis. Appears twice in our New Testament. First of all, in Matthew 1:18 and in Luke 1:14. In Matthew 1:18 is, the birth of Jesus Christ was on this wise. And the word there for birth is our word Genesis. So Genesis can have a variety of meanings. It speaks of origin, source, but also beginning. And no doubt, in view of how the book begins, the word beginning is probably the best translation. But it is a word that is associated with birth as well as the beginning of other things as well. The time covered. Now this is very interesting. As far as can be ascertained, Genesis covers between 2,300 and 2,400 years of history. That is more than the rest of the Bible combined. From creation to the call of Abraham alone covers over 2,000 years. Isn't that interesting? Genesis also covers the first four dispensations. That is, the dispensation of innocence, conscience, human government, and promise. They're all covered in the book of Genesis. Okay? Now I'm sure we're all familiar with those dispensations. Chris very ably went over them a little while ago for us. I understand that was his second time too in relation to it. Maybe I'll just touch on that as a principle. It is vital in order to rightly divide the Word of God to be able to distinguish between the dispensations. I saw a little article by, William MacDonald in a magazine one time about the dispensations. He didn't go into the details of the dispensations. He was responding to the fact that there are so many today that deny dispensational truth. And he just sought to point out that there are obviously very definite changes that take place at different periods of time. For example, there was a very real change that took place when Adam and Eve fell. There had to be a change in their relationship with God because now they were sinners and they couldn't have a relationship with God which was the same as the relationship they had with God at the very beginning. Okay? Now they were going to have to deal with conscience. There was obviously a very definite change that took place at the time of the flood when the vast majority of the human family was destroyed and just one family remained. There are certain changes that took place even as far as the animal kingdom is concerned. Up until then, I would judge that animals were vegetarian. But after that, they were not necessarily vegetarian. And then was introduced human government at that particular time. Now, many of the others could be mentioned, but another obvious change that came in was when the law was given. You will notice in the book of Exodus, in the opening chapters, there were things that the Israelites did that they ought not to have done, but they never got into trouble for doing it. But once the law had been given, for example, when a man went out to gather sticks on the Sabbath day, he was stoned to death. That never happened beforehand. There was a definite change. And then when you come to the New Testament with the death of Christ, obviously another definite change. Now we find that God shelves the Jewish people and begins to deal primarily with Gentile people. That doesn't mean there weren't any Jews saved, but God wasn't dealing with them as a nation. He was just dealing with them as people. And so there was a very definite change when the church came into existence, and we could go on and on from there, but that's a principle that is very important. If we're going to understand the scriptures, we must understand dispensational change. Otherwise, why are we not keeping the Sabbath day? Why are we not offering up animal sacrifices? Why do we not have a temple? All these things have been done away with the death of Christ. Okay. Now, the themes of Genesis. Genesis is not a book of science, but it is totally accurate scientifically. It is not a geography book, but it is totally accurate geographically. It is not a general history book, but it is totally accurate historically. Genesis is the book of origins. It begins with, number one, the origin of the material creation. Number two, the origin of living things. Number three, the origin of man. Number four, the origin of sin. Number five, the origin of human government. Number six, the origin of diverse languages. Number seven, the origin of the nation of Israel, and much else. Okay? So it is vitally important for us to understand that. You see, there are men who claim to be evangelicals, who believe the gospel, who teach that the Bible is inspired as to its theology, but it is not necessarily inspired as to its science and history and geography. The problem with that is, if the Bible isn't to be relied upon for its science and history and geography, how can we be sure that it's reliable theologically? And after all, if God is the God of the Bible, then surely He knows how everything started. Okay? So those are principles that are very important for us to understand. Okay. How to view Genesis? Genesis is to be viewed literally. Now, it is very obvious that from the time of Abraham, and well, actually earlier than that, from chapter 9, what we have is a historical record. It's a selective historical record. It's not a, that's why I used the term general history before. It is not a general history of the world. It's a specific history of a particular people. And it traces those people down through the generations of Noah and Seth and on to Abraham and so on. It's the history of the nation of Israel that primarily is in view. Okay, but it is history. So if what we have in those chapters is historical record, then obviously it is to be viewed literally. If those chapters are to be viewed literally, then obviously what precedes them must be viewed literally. You must apply the same principle right from the beginning, okay? So what is said is what took place. However, Genesis is not to be viewed as mere history. In Hebrews 11:19, in stating the faith of Abraham that God would raise Isaac from the dead, the writer stated from whence also he received him in a figure. And I pointed out that the Greek word used there is the word for a parable. Now, you'll find that principle in the New Testament too. It's a historical record. It's something that actually took place. But it has a hidden meaning, a parabolic meaning. When you come into the book of Luke particularly, you'll notice that there are many statements such as a certain man. I'm going to suggest to you that whenever you read that statement, a certain man or a certain rich man, what you are reading is a case history. It's a particular person that's in view. But in some of the cases, what we have in view is used as a parable. So what the Lord does is He takes an actual story of a person's life and He uses that story to teach a parable. You've got it in the parable of the Good Samaritan. A certain man went down from Jerusalem to Jericho. A certain Samaritan as he journeyed. So it's an actual case history, but the Lord uses it as a parable. Now that's not to say that in every case it's a parable. In Luke chapter 16, for example, the story of the rich man, that very clearly is not a parable. I remember many years ago when we still lived in Abbotsford, we had a Jehovah's Witness lady come to our door, and she said to me, I'll give you, I think it was 10 pounds, or no, 50 pounds, if you can prove to me that there's a hell. Well, I said to her, but the time you found out, you wouldn't be able to pay me. But the point is this. Every parable, in no parable is a person's name mentioned, right? The names are always left out. But we do read of Lazarus, the poor man. He's mentioned by name. Secondly, you can add to that this. Every parable is a true-to-life experience. It talks about the lilies of the field and all sorts of things. But they're true-to-life experiences. Well, the rich man died. That happens, doesn't it? It's a true-to-life experience. And he was buried. Well, that's the normal thing that is done, or was done at least, when a person died. And in hell, he lifted up his eyes being in torment. So it's not a parable. And even if it was a parable, it would be a true-to-life experience. So it would still speak of a person who had actually died and been buried and woke up in hell. Okay? Okay, where are we? Back again to the story of Abraham offering up Isaac. Here's an interesting thing in that connection too, by the way. You will notice that Abraham never did actually offer up Isaac. And so he didn't receive him in resurrection. But the very fact that that was his intention, God gives him the credit for having done so. And so God introduces into the story of Genesis 22 things that actually didn't take place because of this parable. He raised him from the dead. Okay, indicating that there is far more intended in the event than the mere recording of its history. Genesis provides us with prophecies and pictures of Christ. It also teaches us lessons relating to believers and non-believers. It deals with choices and their consequences. As Paul states in Romans 15:4, whatsoever things were written aforetime were written for our learning, that we through patience and comfort of the Scriptures might have hope. This applies very much to Genesis, particularly from chapter 12 onward. Genesis is a character study. I would say Genesis is a character study above every other book in the Old Testament. There are so many wonderful characters. It deals with Abraham and Ishmael, Isaac, Jacob and Esau, Joseph and his brethren. So there are many character studies in the book of Genesis. Galatians 4:24 refers to the story of Isaac and Ishmael and states, which things are an allegory? For these are two covenants, the one from Mount Sinai which gendereth to bondage, which is Agar, that's the father of Ishmael, or the mother rather of Ishmael, Hagar. Now, an allegory is a story with a hidden meaning. Now just bear in mind, this isn't a parable. It was an actual case history. These events actually took place. But God selected these events because of the hidden lesson that he had behind it. And the hidden lesson was in relation to Isaac and Ishmael, the fact that we're not children of the bond woman, but of the free woman. Okay. Genesis provides us with selective history, incidents and people which serve to teach spiritual and moral lessons. Hebrews 7 takes us back to the story of Melchizedek's meeting with Abraham, and teaches us that there is significance in the names of people and places. For example, he is described as Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of the Most High God. Now there is importance not only in the names used there, but the order in which the names appear. He is Melchizedek first. Melchizedek means king of righteousness. He is Melchizedek, king of Salem, and Salem means peace. Righteousness must be established before there can be peace. God cannot bring about peace if it's not done in a righteous fashion. So he is Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of the Most High God. Now, when we get there, we're going to find that's a very interesting study in itself. And I'm not going to say any more about that at this point in time. Okay, so it teaches us that there is significance in the names of the people and places and the order in which the names appear. Also, we learn that there is sometimes a significance in the omission of details as well as the details recorded. Now, what I have in mind there is we're told about Melchizedek, priest of the Most High God. We're not told when he was born. Now that's very interesting because Genesis is a book of births. So-and-so begat so-and-so. So-and-so begat so-and-so. It runs all the way through Genesis. Not only so, we're not told about Melchizedek's death. And Genesis is a book of deaths. And he died, and he died, and he died. It runs all the way through Genesis. Genesis begins with the creation of Adam, and it closes with Joseph being in a coffin in Egypt. So in a book where there is so much emphasis on birth and death, there is no mention of the birth and the death of Melchizedek because of the lesson that is teaching, that he is made like unto the Son of God without beginning of days and without end of life. Now, it's not that he didn't have a beginning of days and an end of life, but his birth is not recorded. His death is not recorded. So in picture, he's going on forever. See, that's the point that's being made. So these are principles that we can learn in connection with the study of the book of Genesis. Okay. Genesis supplies us with much information concerning Christ. In chapter 3, verse 15, he is the seed of the woman. In 13, 15 and 16, he is the seed of Abraham. In chapter 32, 24 to 30, he is the man with whom Jacob wrestled. In chapter 49, verse 10, he is Shiloh, and he's of the tribe of Judah. Now, these are historical details that are actually given in the book of Genesis in relation to the person of Christ. Genesis also supplies us with pictures of Christ. The providing of a wife for Adam from his rib pictures the death of Christ in order that he might have the church as his bride, chapter 2. The coats of skins to cover, and by the way, the word for skin there is in the plural, the coats of skins to cover Adam and Eve required the slaying of innocent victims and pictures for us the death of Christ. In fact, all the animal sacrifices picture the death of Christ. The ark, I'm talking about the Ark of Noah, of course. The ark with its one door reminds us that Christ is the one way to safety from the wrath of God. The story of Genesis 22 is a beautiful picture of the Father giving his Son for us, as is confirmed by the words of the Lord Jesus in John chapter 8, verse 56, your father Abraham rejoiced to see my day, and he saw it and was glad. The whole life of Joseph is a panorama of the life of Christ, including his millennial reign. It begins with the coat of many colors that was given by his father. And that would suggest, to me at least, the pre-incarnate glory of Christ. It deals with the hatred of his brethren and the fact that they sold him to the Ishmaelites, and you know, all know all the story of what happened. And then he was in the prison, and then he was brought out of prison, no doubt picturing for us the resurrection of Christ. And then he becomes Lord over all the land of Egypt. And so it pictures for us Christ in his millennial glory as being Lord over the whole earth. And then in the middle of that story, he was given Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, to be his wife. He's given a Gentile wife. A picture again of the church being the bride of Christ. So these are just some of the details that we can pick up from the book of Genesis. Now, you'll see I've got an outline there for the book. Now, first of all, we've got the simple division of Genesis. There are two ways in which the main divisions can be looked at. Number one, from chapter 1 to 8, we have the world that then was. That's a phrase that's taken from 2 Peter 3:6. Then chapters 9 to 50, the heavens and the earth which now are. That's taken from 2 Peter 3:7. And of course, Peter later goes on to speak about the new heavens and the new earth. So you've got the world that then was, and the heavens and the earth that now are. Those two statements are made very definitely in relation to the world before and subsequent to the flood of Noah's day. Okay? So that's one way in which it can be divided. Chapters 1 to 8, the world that then was. Chapters 9 to 50, the heavens and the earth which now are. The second, which is quite popular, is chapter 1 to 11, verse 26, the primeval period. That's the early period. Chapter 11, verse 27 to 50, now there's some variation as to which verse you should start with, is the patriarchal period, beginning, of course, with Abraham. Okay? So that's the other way of looking at it. Now, I've taken the first way, chapters 1 to 8, the world that then was, and chapters 9 to 50, the heavens and the earth which now are. So it's up to you what way you want to look at it, and you'll see that I've given a division of the chapters, not going into any detail, but that gives us some idea of what's in the book of Genesis. I hope that was helpful. I must say I was a little bit fearful as to how it was going to go. I wasn't sure. It's a new thing for me, but I trust that it will be a blessing to each one.